Hi everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Haunted History Chronicles. In today's episode, we're going to be exploring Salem and the rise of witchcraft in America. Now, we've explored this particular topic and issue from the point of view of the rise of witchcraft in England, specifically around the Pendle Witch Trials. And if you haven't checked out those podcasts where we looked at those in detail, I would recommend you start by listening to those, as the conversation and the topics that came up through those podcasts are very relevant to A, what happened in Salem, but B, to the conversations that are going to be had today. Later on in the episode, we're actually going to be joined by a really special guest to dive deeper and discuss Salem in further detail. And we're going to be able to use that to compare and contrast with what happened with Salem to that of Pendle. So, if you're comfortable and ready, let's get started. When we think of witch trials anywhere in the world, I think number one on nearly everyone's lips would be Salem. Little, I would say, is really known of other American witch trials. In many cases, sadly, the records surrounding these trials have been simply lost over time. To begin this podcast, I thought we would take a look and examine some of these lesser-known cases, to honour their stories, and to understand that America, just like in other countries during this time, was seeing a rise of witchcraft accusations. It's important we remember that, whilst looking at some of the more famous examples, that in fact there are many lesser known cases all around the world, and this is also true of America. And all of these are equally important and deserve to be heard. So let's start by taking a look at a few of them. By the time Salem's witch trial started in 1692, Connecticut, the only colonial American place other than Salem with a significant track record of witch trials and executions, was already beginning to wind down on its half century of persecutions. The majority of those executed as witches, both in Connecticut and elsewhere, were poor women, sometimes single mothers, living on the margins of the local community. Overwhelmingly, the percentage of crimes committed, both moral and otherwise, were in fact acted out by men. But yet, legislation pertaining to moral crimes would largely direct itself to policing the behaviour of women. Legislators and religious figures were, by definition, all male. And as a result, it was women who would bear the brunt of this social and religious prejudice. Female sexuality was especially contentious, and it was around the expression of any degree of independence and sexual freedom by women that many of the charges of witchcraft would arise. There is some evidence that accusations of witchcraft against women were also, at least in part, based on individuals' greed. In many cases, for example, the women accused were married but did not have male children, which meant they were in line to inherit their husband's estate, should they outlive him. In the event of a woman dying before her husband and without producing a male heir, the man's property upon his death went to the community. Let's just take a moment to think about what that means. If you want to stop a woman from holding land and property, then make sure she isn't alive and around when her husband dies. And if that doesn't work, then take it back if you find her guilty of witchcraft. Some of these elements factored into the case of Alsa Young, who was purported to be the first person in colonial America executed as a witch. It was also something that possibly played out to some degree in the Salem trials, and might explain why some of the older women in the community were also targeted. Between 1647 and 1697, it's estimated about 36 people were charged with witchcraft in Connecticut. Now, we can't be exact, as many of the court records have been lost. 11 were executed, all by hanging. 9 of the 11 were women. The 2 men executed were hanged, along with their wives. Of those who weren't executed, some would flee the community, others would be banished. Here are some of those stories. In 1647, 5 years after Connecticut made witchcraft a crime punishable by death, Hartford saw the first witch-related execution in colonial America when Elsie Young was sent to the gallows. No records of her trial survive, so details of her case are thin and limited. There is speculation, however, that she might have been responsible for an epidemic of witchcraft accusations in a nearby community. Very little is known about Elsa. We know she was born around the year 1600 and resided in Windsor, Connecticut. We know that in later life she would marry a man named John Young, and that they would give birth to a daughter who would be called Alice. We know that in 1647 she would find herself accused of witchcraft and hanged in Hartford in May of that year. Her daughter and her husband would survive her. We also know that 30 years later, her daughter, Alice, also stood accused of being a witch in Springfield, Massachusetts. Although Alice did not hang, the historical records are unclear as to what punishment she would receive instead. Connecticut's second executed witch was named Mary Johnson, and she would be sent to the gallows in 1648 after having been detained and tortured for many years. Under duress, she would admit to familiarity with the devil and uncleanness with men and devils, thereby providing the very first recorded confession of witchcraft in the American colonies. Her hanging would be delayed so she could give birth to a child, the father of which was someone she was not married to. When Connecticut's witch purges began, just one single witness was all that was needed to mount a trial and conviction. So if you had just one vindictive enemy, or neighbour, or someone who stood to gain financially from your downfall, then a witchcraft prosecution may result. It didn't take much. And like examples of so many other witch persecutions around the world, circumstances would be such that rooting out a witch and providing evidence of guilt would be an easy thing to do. Women were disproportionately targeted and could even be blamed for a man's misdeeds or recklessness. One instance that highlights this is the story of Lydia Gilbert from Windsor, Connecticut. She would be arrested after a man accidentally shot and killed another man. It was Lydia who would be found guilty of this murder and sentenced to death for causing the incident through her witchcraft. Connecticut witch hunting reached its peak in 1662 with the Hartford Witch Panic, which saw 3 witches executed within just a few weeks. By this time, testimony from multiple witnesses was required in order to obtain a witchcraft conviction. Key authority figures, including Connecticut's colonial governor John Winthrop the Younger, had begun to question the value of the evidence in these witch trials, as the possible agendas of the witnesses may have been biased. It's no surprise, therefore, that many of the accused after 1662 were acquitted, and some were even awarded damages for having been slandered. In 1668, Catherine Harrison of Wethersfield, Connecticut, was found guilty of witchcraft. In this instance, the court refused to impose the death sentence, despite many wanting for this execution to go ahead. By then, methods of interrogation that involved hot irons and boiling water were deemed diabolical. In 1692, the same year that the Salem witch trials began, Fairford, Connecticut saw an outbreak of witchcraft accusations, but none would result in execution. Though witchcraft would technically remain a capital crime in Connecticut until the 18th century, the courts there were growing sceptical and weary of witchcraft trials. Too many of them, it seemed, were the result of personal feuds. Salem, though, was descending into a lethal hysteria. 20 witches executed in less than 4 months. And it's here that our story begins. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. Exodus, verse 22, line 18. The Salem witch trials began during the spring of 1692 in Salem Village in Massachusetts, and would continue well into May of 1693 with dwindling ferocity. The tragedy of Salem is something that has endured well into the 20th century. Even when courts would deem these events unlawful and restore the names of the families involved and offer financial restitution, the scars would still linger. More than 200 people would stand accused. 30 would be found guilty, with 19 of this figure being executed by hanging. More would die in jail, and one man, Giles Corey, aged 81, would be pressed to death torturously over a period that lasted 3 days for simply refusing to plead guilty. A sanction that remains the only example in American history. Those arrested in Salem and beyond would stand before the court of Oyer and Termina in 1692, and by a superior court of judicature in 1693 in Salem. Salem, the place where the trials, executions and burials would all take place. As you hear this, try and picture what life would have been like and the fear that people had. How easy it was for hysteria to take hold and for events to cascade. Life in Puritan Salem was not without challenge. Threats from North American tribes and sickness, as well as fear of outsiders from their community, were an everyday reality. Salem was wrought with internal conflicts and disputes. Arguments and disagreements were commonplace over property boundary lines and grazing rights, to name a few. Accusations and quarrels between neighbours and members of the community were common and would often stir allegations of witchcraft. Those that did not conform to the expected norms of Puritan lifestyle would be viewed with a critical eye and often suffer similar allegations, especially women who were unmarried or without children. With the belief that men and women were equal in the eyes of God, but not equal in the eyes of the devil, it was commonly thought that women were inherently sinful and more prone to damnation than men. Their weaker bodies and frailty of mind would leave them vulnerable to sources of evil and sin. This is the backdrop of what was to take place. In February 1692, Betty Paris, aged 9, and her cousin Abigail Williams, aged 11, would begin to present with terrifying fits beyond anything seen before as part of any illness. The girls would scream and thrash and throw things. Their bodies would contort and they would utter strange sounds. They would complain of feeling pinched and pricked by pins. William Griggs, a local doctor, attended the girls and diagnosed that they were bewitched. Not long afterwards, other girls, including Anne Putnam Jr., Mercy Lewis, Elizabeth Hubbard, Mary Warren, and Mary Walcott, would exhibit the same terrifying symptoms. Fear began to grip this community, and investigations started in order to seek out the cause of these bewitchments. By late February, arrest warrants would be issued first for a slave named Tituba of the Paris household, along with a homeless beggar, Sarah Good, and an elderly poor woman named Sarah Osborne. Each of these women were outcasts for different reasons. Tituba was more than likely selected for her differing ethnicity. Sarah Osborne was rarely seen in church and was considered of low morals and self-serving. Sarah Good, as a destitute woman, was frowned upon and condemned for a reputation of lacking self-control. All three were brought before the local magistrate, questioned for several days, whilst their accused were brought before them writhing and contorting, before being thrown back in jail. Good and Osborne both denied their guilt strongly. Tituba would confess, and in confessing she would act as an informant, giving names of other witches to save herself. Soon others would also be accused. Martha Corey, who doubted the validity of the accusations made by the girls. Dorothy Good, who was only 4 years old and the daughter of Sarah Good, was not exempt. Rebecca Nurse would also be accused, along with one other, outside of Salem, independent from the accusations of the girls. This community was deeply troubled. Martha Corey and Rebecca Nurse were members of the church and held in extreme high esteem. Speculation and anxiety over this turn of events was widespread. If these good women could be accused and fall foul of witchcraft, then who else amongst them could also be witches and in league with evil? In April, Sarah Cloyce, the sister of Rebecca Nurse, would be arrested as a witch, as too was Elizabeth Proctor. Both women were taken before the magistrates for examination. When John Proctor protested at the arrest of his wife, he too was arrested. Within a week, Giles Corey, the husband of Martha, would also be arrested, along with Abigail Hobbs, Bridget Bishop, Deliverance Bishop, and Mary Warren. Abigail and Mary, like Tituba before them, would confess and beginning naming others as witches. As more and more arrest warrants were issued and trials carried out, it began to overwhelm the local justice system. In May 1692, William Phipps, the newly elected local governor of Massachusetts, would order the establishment of a special court. The court of Oyer, meaning to hear, and determiner, to decide. It was convened on June 2nd in Salem. Bridget Bishop was the first to stand before the court. She was found guilty and hanged 8 days later on what would become known as Gallows Hill. July would see five more hanged, as would August. In September, eight would be found guilty and suffer the same fate. For those awaiting trial, conditions in the jail were poor, and seven would die before reaching court, dying in the filth and cramped conditions of the cells. Whilst in prison, the men and women would often be kept chained to the walls and often stripped and examined. Giles Corey, who refused to plead guilty at his arraignment, would slowly die, agonisingly, under the increasing weight of the large stones pressing into his body, an act that took 3 days. Those convicted and hanged would have their bodies immediately cut down from the trees and buried in shallow, unmarked graves. Excommunicated from their church, the crowd watching them would then disperse. May 1693 would see the last trial. Governor Phipps, by this point, had already dissolved the Court of Oyer and Determiner and organise the successor to ignore all spectral evidence. Phipps would release and pardon all those still in prison accused of witchcraft. After the trials and executions, many would confess their error and guilt over what had happened. What happened in Salem impacted on the whole community. The accusations made, many consider to be out of revenge or petty quarrels, or sadly to try and save themselves. Others believe that the consumption of contaminated rye grain may have led to ergot poisoning, causing mass hallucinations, something that would feed the fear and superstitions and beliefs they already had. What we do know, though, is that nobody would be spared. What happened over this period touched the lives of all. The church offered no protection, nor did age or infirmity. Dorothy Good, who was incarcerated at the age of 4, would spend 8 months in jail before being pardoned and released. Her childlike confessions used as evidence to convict and later execute her mother. On January 15, 1697, Puritans held a day of prayer known as the Day of Official Humiliation to plead their forgiveness to God. For decades, family members and supporters would try and have the judgments overturned and to establish the innocence of their loved ones. It would take 250 years for Massachusetts to officially apologise for the events of 1692. So at this point, let's say hello to my guest who's joining us for this segment of the podcast. Hi, Joseph. Thank you for coming along today.
Hi, Michelle. I'm excited to be here.
Same. I'm really looking forward to this one. I know it's one that we've been talking about for a while, so I'm really excited. Could you start by maybe telling us a little bit about yourself and your company and what it is that you do for anyone who doesn't know you?
Sure. So again, my name is Joseph, and I was actually a ghost tour guide that I work at in several cities in the U.S. And I currently am a tour operations manager with U.S. Ghost Adventures and Salem Ghosts. And you can find us at usghostadventures.com or salemghosts.com. And what I do now is I'm a jack of all trades. We just got through the Halloween season, so that was a lot of fun and very busy. But I manage and operate tours that we hold around the country, but specifically we're talking about Salem Ghosts, so that's in Salem, Massachusetts. And I help also with the development of new tours or new activities and experiences that we can do in cities like Salem, where it's very popular and people are always looking for more paranormal things or related things to do. And of course, being a ghost tour guide, and especially in October and Halloween, I jump in and I still give ghost tours as needed. And I have a lot of fun and telling people haunted history, ghost sightings, and just anything that I find fascinating or spooky.
Sounds like the dream job to me.
Yes, you could say that. It's always changing, but there's a good foundation of what we have. And, you know, luckily we are able to fall back on, you know, history. I like to call it haunted history. And then no matter what people believe in, there's always the unexplained. So the potential is limitless, and there's always fun things to do and always people interested in it, especially people I'm hoping who are going to be listening to this podcast.
Yeah, perfect. And I hope that people who don't necessarily know about you find you, maybe come along, visit one of your locations that you do, because this is all about the community around these common interests, really, for me. So let's get going. I can't wait. As you know, over here on the podcast, we've kind of talked about the rise of witchcraft in England and specifically focused on kind of a very famous witch trial, which is the Pendle witch trial. And we've looked at the paranormal, which is also a topic of interest in that area, as well as the history. And on this podcast, we've also looked at the rise of witchcraft in America and in Salem. So I'm kind of interested in if, as a starting point, you've got any personal experiences of Salem, any paranormal activity, any stories associated with the area that you want to share with those listening.
Absolutely. And see, you know, you have, like I said, the haunted history, and you have all these connections that you have from, the United Kingdom into America, and this process that builds up from, over hundreds and hundreds of years. But what's unique in Salem is that there's always people going there, and there's always something going on year round, whether you people believe in paranormal activity or they're just going there for a good scare. So it's almost impossible not to, I don't want to say everybody has an experience, but it's almost impossible to go to Salem and at least not feel for most people that something is going on. There's this energy that's there, whatever people want to call it, dark energy or magical energy, paranormal energy. So regardless of the experiences that people have, people go there and they, when they leave, whether they had fun or was too scary or whatever it is, they leave knowing that there's something different about Salem. And what I like about it and what I've experienced is that in the past, there's all these different, what I like to call them, hotspots where things happened in history. And when I talk about my tours and I give tours, I always tell people that it's not about just the history. Okay, yes, this place is old. Yes, lots of stuff happened here, but it's what, how people lived and what happened to them in the final moments before their death or even after their death that ties that energy and that activity to those specific locations. And Salem has so many, not just because of the witch trials, but because of its long history and because the witch trials themselves lasted for months. And so when you go there in the present day, there's cemeteries, there's unmarked graves, there's lots of places that might be covered with storefronts that used to be a place where either someone was hanged or, and I'm going to share my favorite experience right now where someone claims that there's a ghost or sightings frequently at a specific location. And one of those locations is Turner's Seafood. It's a restaurant that people claim to consistently have sightings of a woman who is seen in the bathroom at the top of the stairs, and she has these bruises on her neck. And she is either standing in the bathroom and you can only see her in the reflection, or she's when you're leaving, and let's say you saw her in the bathroom or you heard about her and you turn to look back up the stairs. You see her standing there looking at you, and you can even see her through the window sometimes. And this is something that people go there just to talk about, and they don't always experience this. But me myself, when I even knowing that it happened, going there and actually seeing what I thought was this paranormal activity and this spirit or ghost was probably one of the most interesting experiences of my life, because you can talk about it all you want. You can give ghost tours and you can we can talk about the history, but when you see something that either is unexplained or you tell people, okay, I know you're not going to believe this, but I just saw a ghost, that's almost life-changing.
I completely agree. And for people who are skeptics, it takes experiencing something that they can't explain for themselves to really understand the draw, because it's totally momentous. You know, it is life changing. It's fascinating. And when you have a moment like that, whenever it happens or if it ever happens, it really does kind of change your way of thinking, I think.
Absolutely. And see, the ironic thing, or maybe no, not the ironic thing, the thing that is not a coincidence is who that character is supposed to be. And that's why Salem to me is so interesting, and the potential, if you want to call it that, for sightings or experiences is limitless, because people go there believing or wanting to believe these things, and it has all this history, and it is this, it's almost like an entire. So let's say you go to somewhere in the UK that's known to be have a hotspot, or you go to somewhere in the United States that is known to have haunted locations. When people go to Salem, they go there expecting the entire town to be one giant paranormal hotspot of activity, of people going there to, research, going there to experience things, going to all the different memorials, the museums, the stores, everything that has to do with these witch trials. So instead of just being one lo location, like a house or a building, there are so many. And it almost think, like if you were look at it maybe from like Google Maps, and you were to imagine like a dome covering this entire town, that's the only way I can describe how the city of Salem, Massachusetts appears in people's minds when you say, oh, hey, have you been to Salem? It's an entire town that people associate with paranormal.
And Pendle is slightly different in that regard, because Pendle is a hill, and then the various locations attached to the Pendle witch trials are these very, very tiny hamlets, these tiny villages
dotted around the hill itself. So it's spread across a wide area, but very, very small places. It's not a huge town. So it's much more isolated in terms of location. But what it does have is this beautiful hill kind of marking the area. So it's beautiful landscape. It's pretty barren.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, there are spots that a lot of people go there and they know a little bit of the lore. They know that the Salem witch trials happened. They might know one or two of the names, but they really don't know the history. And so when you have a sighting like the one at Turner Seafood, and then you do some research or you ask a tour guide or ask a historian, they'll tell you, well, you know what? The reason that person is there, if you believe it, looking at history, is that's where the first person who was hung, Bridget Bishop, during the Salem witch trials, that's actually not where she was hung, but that is where she was at first accused of being a witch based on something. And of course, you probably know this, you know, with your research and doing the podcast, based on that phenomenon that you, some people would call superstition, but they actually called spectral evidence back then. And that's when her neighbor was supposedly chasing a monster off of his land. And as soon as it crossed over on, according to him, onto the Bishop property, that monster became Bridget Bishop. And that was some of the basis for the foundation of why she was accused and why she was later hung. And so people might say they see her at the gallows memorial, but most people actually cite her where she was first accused and supposedly first seen in that spectral evidence. And that's what's so crazy about that.
Yeah, and I think the same thing is true of Pendle. There are lots of different sightings across lots of different places, sometimes the same spirit seen in multiple locations and for different reasons, but they, when you research it, they're all tied back to something else and some part of what actually happened during that time. So it's fascinating, the more you kind of dive into these areas to really see the connection with the history and exactly what happened. So yeah, two amazing places, I think. Different, similar, but amazing.
Absolutely. So,
do you have a favorite person from the Salem trials who kind of stands out for you?
Yeah, and I mean, maybe it's because I'm someone who's always a fan of what I like to call maybe the unsung hero, or someone who... And I know you talked about this in your podcast. Like I said, this whole leading up of superstition and religious beliefs and people being scared and people somehow, whether you want to call it mob mentality, getting to the point where they did these things, they had these trials. It wasn't just one night. It was over a course of time that transferred from the UK all the way to eventually America and Salem and the Salem witch trials. And then after that, there were Virginia witch trials. So almost like the tsunami of superstition, religious beliefs, fear, whatever you want to call it. And yet somehow in the middle of all that, when governors and lieutenant generals, whatever you want to call them, when the son of the president of Harvard, Cotton Mather, all these influential people, ministers, are saying all these things, there's someone who is somehow able to have that fortitude of strength. Whether he was right or wrong, according to them or us, he still was saying, you know what? Everyone is saying this. I'm going to say the opposite. And Giles Corey was that person, and he was punished for it. And the way he was punished for it was they pressured him, and they finally used the method of torture called pressing. And it has a French phrase, I believe. It's called pied fort à dur. And it's basically putting stones on. And it's not just about torture. It's not just about, and of course, you know, in the history of the UK, of course, you know, whether you're looking at the reign of Henry VIII or anywhere, there's all forms of torture. But it was a way to continue to try to get him to confess to crimes that he believed he didn't have. And he died, you know, during that. And to me, even when we learned this in school, he was the one that I could always remember. It was sad what happened to all the young ladies. It's sad what happened to the slave, Tituba. It was sad. The entire thing was a tragedy. But what happened to him, to me, is that still he went all the way to the end and never said anything. And to me, that's heroic.
Am I right in thinking that because he didn't actually confess, it meant that when he passed away, his land wasn't forfeited to the community, so it was actually able to pass on to his children, his son.
And so that's how it's supposed to work, and it was able to pass along. But the unique thing about his torture and him refusing to enter a plea of guilty, that pressing torture in the effort to force him to plead is the only example of a sanction like that kind of torture that's documented in American history. It's the only one.
Because it was brutal.
Exactly. Exactly.
Absolutely brutal.
Well, and it was brutal, but I'm sure that it's happened before, and people have been hung before, and there's of course lots of documents of hangings. Even to this day, some states, that's how they have capital punishment, is hanging. But the fact that it was the only time where it was sanctioned by a judge and by the authorities of that area in entire American history, and documented that they said this is legal, made it unique, and they still weren't able to break him. And then, of course, since he didn't plead guilty, is they didn't have any supposed right to take his land away.
I heard somewhere that in his dying breath, didn't he curse the magistrate or the sheriff or something? And so it's kind of been passed down as legend that every single sheriff or someone associated with Salem since then has had tragedies in their lifetime based on those utterances. I'm sure I've heard that somewhere.
Well, yeah, so yeah, exactly. So mainly, and this is another part of how I like the story, is that he didn't he three times over the course of 2 days, so 48 hours plus, he was asked to enter a plea, and each time his single reply was two words, more weight. Even when he could barely breathe and barely get the words out, he would say this, and the sheriff would even stand on the stones on top of him, adding more weight, and he would say more weight. And at the end, you are correct, and this is told in addition to the more weight, and it was dramatized in the book The Crucible. Some people said he said more rocks, but the rumors are that it said that he says at the end, "Damn you, I curse you and Salem." So he's actually not cursing the specific person, but he's cursing the entire city of Salem. And why that's significant is because people, his wife was hanged 3 days later, which was horrible also. But why that's relevant is because people believe, and this is some of the signs that people see, that his apparition appears and walks by his graveyard, which technically no one knows exactly where he is buried, because all of the hangings and all of the people executed were buried in a mass grave or in different graves, and some of their families came and took them and buried them on their local land and local plots, but no one knows exactly where all of them are buried. But people see him walking near his graveyard where people think it is, and it happens each time, supposedly, that some disaster strike the city. For example, like the Great Salem Fire of 1914, and other smaller events that happened. So he cursed the city of Salem, and people believe that because of that, it wasn't just people involved, but that the entire town held the responsibility of that tragedy.
I have a similar person who interests me in Pendle for kind of the same reasons that you've shared. In the Pendle witch trials, there was one lady who kind of stood out as being very different to the other women and men accused, and that was Alice Nutter. And she stood out because she was rich, she was educated, and she owned land. So she was very different to the other people accused who tended to come from the poorest parts of society within these communities. She was only put on trial based on the one testimony of Janet Davis, who was this very young 9-year-old girl who placed her at this meeting in Malkin Towers. Based on just that one bit of testimony that she'd been there, she was rounded up with the others. She was put on trial, where she only spoke once, and that was to say that she was not guilty. She was found guilty and subsequently hung. Now, the fact that she was accused of being in this one location, when you kind of think about that, is really just totally unrealistic because she was wealthy, she was educated, and she owned land. Why would she have any reason to be in this very poor, rundown building in the middle of the night? She had no reason to be there. So it's really strange that she was rounded up and accused along with those people who'd been at this meeting. When you kind of examine the history of it, she actually had a personal connection with the local magistrate who was involved in carrying out the trials himself, Roger Knoll, and it was a land dispute. And she'd been so strong a woman that she'd openly kind of challenged him about this land dispute and walked into a meeting which he was holding and confronted him in this meeting. And it went to trial and everything else, and he lost the lawsuit. And so he had a real personal vendetta against this woman because she'd been strong enough to stand up to him as part of some other dispute. And many believe that actually that's the reason why she was dragged into it, simply because of some personal vendetta. And he used this opportunity to throw her in the mix and get her out of the way. But in pleading not guilty and saying nothing, she also, it also meant that she didn't throw anyone else into this trial because she was a known Catholic. Catholics were being rounded up. They were also being hung if found guilty. And so by her silence, she spared probably an awful lot of people within the community from suffering the same fate. Really strong, very, very strong woman, and someone to really admire. So I think for the same reason, she really stands out for me, just having that bravery to either speak up or sometimes say nothing to make the situation worse for someone else. Pretty strong woman.
Absolutely. And I think that, I can't imagine what kind of courage it takes to do that, or the kind of, personality and character, you would have to have, not just in doing that for yourself, but, in doing that for other people also, I mean, 'cause they didn't know that these would continue into centuries and later, and we'd be talking about it now. They didn't know that they would become famous or infamous, and they didn't know that eventually, like Giles, he would be acquitted after, the fact, after he was already dead. They just did it because it's what they believed.
And also, they had no idea the ramifications for other trials and other people in other countries, like Jennet Davis, the young 9-year-old girl in Pendle. Her testimony executed her entire family, not just her friends in the local community, but 3 generations. Her entire family were gone. She was totally alone after that as a 9-year-old child. And skip forward 20 years, she found herself on trial for similar charges of witchcraft based on the testimony of another young child. Now, she was spared the fate of hanging, even though she was found guilty. It was actually dropped based on the king stepping in, examining it, the Privy Council getting involved and looking again and talking to the eyewitnesses. And it was found to be fraudulent. But she didn't get out of prison because she couldn't afford the charges that, she'd racked up by being in the jail cell. So she died in there. Now, her testimony as that young child paved the way for everything else. It was the first time in law that a child was used to give evidence about witchcraft. And that paved the way for Salem, for everything else, because it set that precedent, and it was a dangerous one. Do you think, did she know that doing that? Of course not. But she certainly had that impact, and she's known for that. And that's really quite scary in some regards, isn't it? How one person, one moment can really kind of be a match lit spreading elsewhere. And she's very much a catalyst for that one, I think.
Absolutely. And see, you talk about children and the influence that, how can a child, have that much influence on an entire community and in subsequent events that echo not just days, weeks, months, but years and even centuries into the future. And it was children also that started the witch trial. I mean, it was Martha Goodwin, who was 13 in 1688. And Goody Glover, the laundress, was hanged, of course. But and that Reverend Cotton Mather, the son of the president of Harvard, took Martha Goodwin into his house, and he was one of the most actually influential to starting the trials and to keeping them going after this first 13-year-old girl exhibits bizarre behavior, supposedly because the laundress Glover, bewitched her. And then you fast forward 4 years to an 11-year-old, Abigail Williams, and a 9-year-old, Elizabeth Paris, and it starts again, and it lasts for, I think it was about 350, let's see, 350 days of, no, 348 days, almost just short of 1 year. is when finally, after Abigail Williams and Elizabeth Parris started behaving erratically, you know, if you want to call it that, until, and that was in January 20, 1692, until January 3 in 1693, when they finally ordered the suspension of any further execution. Of course, all of these people had died by then, by hanging, multiple hangings, and by pressing, and it just so much.
It builds momentum. That's the scary thing, isn't it? It just keeps growing and growing and growing like a pebble down a hill, gathering speed and so on. It's scary how quickly it can escalate and how it can spread to other communities.
And can you imagine being there, even whether you were, even if you weren't a part of it, you were just a witness or you lived in town? I mean, we talk about, you know, going on a ghost tour or having experience or a sighting, which is intense enough. But if you're there when something this momentous happens, and over the course of a period of time, I just, it's almost like being in a scary movie, being in a horror flick, watching this stuff happen and build up, and then people start to see things. And maybe you do. Maybe you're one of those people who say, yeah, you know what? They are a witch. I saw something crazy. I saw her turn into a black cat, or I saw this spectral evidence. And, you know, people get caught up in that. But being in that atmosphere, it actually gives me the chills sometimes when I used to study it, and I used to read about it, thinking of being in this wooded Puritan little community. And this happening at day, at night, having torches at night. I mean, I don't even know what the word is to describe it, you know?
It's terrifying, is what it is, because
Terrifying.
I think fear can have such a hold and a really strong hold on people that we can sit here and question, you know, how could they do that? Why would they do that? But to have that level of fear is intense, and I think it can spark all manner of different behaviors and accusations and things simply because they were frightened and they didn't know, and it meant that they'd started doubting their neighbors and their friends and anyone else. Unless you're there, I think it's a very hard thing to really kind of get your head around unless you experience it for yourself. But it's terrifying nonetheless that it can happen. And I think that's the significant takeaway from these things. You know, we have to kind of learn from them so that history doesn't repeat itself, because it so easily could. And the fact is, we still have modern persecutions of witches to this day, and that's equally terrifying. There are parts of the world where these things still happen. And that's awful. That's really tragic and awful. And it shouldn't happen, but it does.
Yes, and I think that the one consistent factor isn't, oh, it happens in maybe an underdeveloped country, or it happens in somewhere where, you know what, I doesn't affect me, so it's not really a big deal. It happens because of fear, but also because of superstition, and most importantly, in most cases, some kind of religious connection, whether it's people executing Christians in the Philippines or Indonesia or China, or people having racial and ethnic conflicts in Africa, or you know, even people, if you want to go so far, it might not be witch persecution, but people having different ideologies and political associations in United Kingdom and America. And it I fully firmly believe that that kind of things can escalate to where you would have to call it persecution. Now, it's not necessarily just superstition, but even with political things, it's connected to a lot of times fear, superstition, and religion.
And I think that's why these are so significant, aren't they? Because that difference, and we've seen it echoed so many times through history, haven't we? Difference can be such a powerful kind of way of separating people in communities so that this kind of thing does happen. And like you said, persecution of some kind, be it for all those different reasons, is something that we've seen happen time and time and time and time again, and using that as a means to be cruel and be unkind and to do these things. It's not okay to persecute someone for those kinds of beliefs just because they're different, or fear because we're different, you know, of that difference.
And
So
you know what's terrifying to me, that word is perfect for to describe what happened. What's terrifying to me is that the idea that someone could look back on when we're living right now and call some of these situations that we might be in, or that we might be in the future, we don't know, and use the word terrifying to describe them.
yeah.
That's what's really terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you think there are any other reasons for why, Salem Pendle holds so much significance for people that we still talk about them today? Is there any other reasons that you can think of?
I think that people want to look at history, and this is related to what we just talked about, and they want to say that this is interesting or terrifying or, amazing, some people would call it, because it's different, because this could never happen right now. So when they read or talk about, Pendle Hill or Salem, they think, okay, this is something out of a story. This is it's what I wouldn't call it a fairy tale, but this is something out of a story. Even though they know it actually happened, to them it's still almost not real. But it's something that excites them. And when they do make that connection that these were real people and this stuff really happened, it's like on any ghost tour investigation, any place you go, that's why the haunted history is so important. Because when people know, when they stand in that spot where someone, committed suicide and jumped out a window, or someone stabbed their lover who was having an affair, or a child was killed, or all these different stories that happen that create those paranormal locations where those spirits or that energy is tied to that spot, then when they know it's real, it feels more real to them even in the present. And I think that, like you said, in Pendle, it's more spread out to the different hamlets over a wide area. But as soon as, even though people might not make that connection when they're not there yet, once they get there and they stand in that spot and they hear that story and they know, if they can imagine it and they have that empathy that someone else, something horrible happened to them in this very spot, that's not something that you can dismiss lightly or forget. And I think that that's what people want to feel to some extent when they do visit these places. It's not just about the history, it's about the connection to something that they didn't really feel was real until they were there.
Yeah, I agree. Those are powerful things, aren't they? They're not easy things to shake off. When you know the truth and when you see something for the reality that it was, it stays with you. And it should stay with you because these are stories and these are real people. And we shouldn't forget them. We should remember them and we should remember the horror of some of the things that they went through. So, like we said, so that we don't repeat those same mistakes and those same awful things again. I think Pendle is slightly different because, unlike Salem, it hasn't had this huge focus and spotlight on it for a very long, significant period of time. Witchcraft in general isn't something that we talk about hugely over here. It's not something we teach in schools. It gets a light touching, but not to the extent that you have over there, where you've had films about it, you teach it in schools. Over here, Pendle really kind of had this one moment, which was a television crew coming into the area and it being a focus, that kind of live paranormal investigation, which went on for, several days, really put a spotlight on this one event and this one location. And from there, then over the last few decades, there have been moments again which have helped kind of put that spotlight back on it to keep it really fresh in people's minds. Other stories from across the country of similar events are much. Aren't as well known, which is a shame really, but it's very different, I would say, where for Salem, it's so much part of the culture, isn't it? And has been for a very, very long time over there.
When really quick before I get into Salem, and the contrast of Salem versus, versus Pendle, you said, I think, when we were talking before, you said that even though there isn't a lot of that, and you said there's no class or let's say assignment usually during your education where you focus solely on those trials, and
Not at
it's
all.
not like a whole chapter in a history book.
No, not at all. And I'm speaking from personal experience because I am actually a teacher. It is not part of what we teach in the curriculum. It
Right.
will get a very, very light touch based on, religious persecution. So it will get mentioned, but not to the depth and degree that you have over there.
And
And for that reason, they don't know about these personal stories. And I think it really does take people taking an interest in the local community stories and noticing the things that they have in their towns and their villages and so on, because these are dotted everywhere and they aren't known. And because it's not taught explicitly, so much of it goes over people's heads. And Pendle in many ways is a kind of a different example, simply because it was so well known and because it had this spotlight put on it by this very famous television programme over here at the time called Most Haunted. And it was kind of the first of its kind to really go into those paranormal investigative shows and so on. It really meant that it drew a lot of attention and a lot of interest. Everything that's happened since there, sometimes it takes one thing, doesn't it, to kind of make people aware of it. But for that reason, all these other places around the UK don't have the same kind of attention. So yeah, very different to how it happens over here in terms of education and so on to what you have over in the States. Completely different.
And you said there's some pubs, there's some shops, maybe some monuments and markets, you know, but that's the extent of it. And I'd like to ask you, on a whole, why is that specifically that you think, like, I know that Halloween isn't like a huge holiday like it is over here, but I always grew up thinking, you know what, the history of the UK has millennia, or if not, you know, centuries, if not millennia more. So you have so much more to learn. And I was envious, but at the same time, I was glad that I didn't have to learn so much. But and as a teacher, you know, you can understand that that's relevant to you. But why do you think that, even if it's not, we're not talking about Halloween yet and we're not talking about Salem yet, why do you think it has something to do with the culture of people being either ashamed of the history, and not just Pendle, but on the UK and Scotland and that whole area as a whole? Is why is it that people either, do they shy away from it? Is it just coincidence or chance? Or is there another reason why it takes a TV show not just to shine a spotlight on the, you know, the Pendle Witch trials, but on that these things happened there first and happened multiple times and set the stage for something that echoed through, you know, centuries all the way into the other side of the world?
I think it is tied a lot into the fact that this is around the subject of witchcraft. And I would say it's a bit more of a taboo subject over here. I think we do have certainly a rise of witchcraft in this country. You know, people are interested in Wicca, but it's much more quiet. It's much more on the down low. For that reason, I think those kinds of topics can be contentious issues, particularly in an education setting where you might have parents that complain or religious groups that complain. And people are sometimes nervous about talking about those things in case it creates a debate that they don't want to handle and they don't want to talk about. That's a shame, because it is very much what went on. You know, if you weren't the majority religion and on the receiving end of being accused of being a witch, right, simply because of your religion, that's just the fact. And so, like I said, I think it's simply because witchcraft is still a little bit of a taboo subject,
right?
And people are fearful of that.
Yes, and I think that's where the contrast really stands out. And I think you can look at it from the first point is historically, that wasn't maybe a turning point in the history of the UK per se, but in America, this is one of the first settlements. You know, these are the Puritans. This is the whole reason that they came to America, was for religious freedom. At least yeah, that's the main reason. And to have that so directly connected to this horrible event is number one foundation for things that came afterwards. But number two, also, I believe, you know, it's because, like you said, it was children that were involved in this. It wasn't just, you know, adults. It wasn't just a murder. But number three, I think that it continued, and there was another factor that a lot of people don't talk about, but that was the, not just the influence of superstition and religious beliefs from the United Kingdom, but the contrast of that with the Native Americans that were already there in America, because you have these people who, yes, escaped for religious freedom, but at the same time, at least in their own minds, were still, you know, citizens, colonists from the United Kingdom, and they had these religious beliefs, and these Native Americans were this strange foreign, even though it was their land, entity that worshiped the land and worshiped spirits and had these rituals that they did. And instead of saying, okay, you know what, this is something just different, it went back to, okay, I need to somehow put this in perspective, and I can only conceive that on the basis of religion. So if we're good and we're what's right and we worship God, guess what? These Native Americans worship Satan. And that's literally what they believed. And they also believed that by being in proximity to them, that they would be, they didn't use the word bewitched at that point, but that they would be influenced by this close approximation or this close locale of being near these Native Americans who supposedly worship Satan. And there was even some reverend who said, not just in Massachusetts, but in Virginia, where I started doing ghost tours, that the devil, I think the quote was, the devil is here and alive and at work in Virginia like no other place in the world. And that was simply because of their proximity to these Native Americans. So all of those put together, religious, all of this, unlike Pendle, starts this avalanche. And just like, I could probably refer, and of course I don't want to get into it because, one, you're a teacher, so you I'm sure you really know a lot about the history of the United Kingdom. But just like Shakespeare and the history of I guess what you want to call it, monarchy in England, you have all these plays, you have all the this literature. Well, from Salem, this is the beginning of the history of the United States, and that avalanche started, and from that came plays, books. It even influenced literature to the point that Nathaniel Hawthorne, who was a descendant of one of the judges of Judge Hawthorne from Salem Witch Trials, was influenced when he wrote some of his works, like The Scarlet Letter, being influenced by his history and being ashamed of that. And then that continues into our literature. So the echoes are endless, and they continue to reverberate. And then you have me, learning this in school in at the end of the 20th century. And it's still going. And the city of Salem, even back then, I knew when someone said Salem, Massachusetts, we're acting out these witch trials for class. It was a major portion of our education to learn this. And then it keeps going and going into, I don't want to call it a circus, but into a city that has such an influence and a draw to people that even in the middle of a global pandemic and the coronavirus, that the mayor of Salem stands up in a press conference and eventually gets national attention and says that, yes, we know that 500,000 people come to Salem during October and, of course, other times of the year to experience this, to see what's going on, to see the dozens and hundreds of shops, to visit the cemeteries, the memorials, the markers, the graves, to see, and experience not just the tragedy of what happened, but everything that's come with that. But guess what? We want you to stay away because we're afraid because of this pandemic. And guess what? People didn't stay away. People were scared of the pandemic, but not to an extent that they could hold themselves back and not go visit Salem during October, even in the middle of everything. It was complete chaos, and I would call it a circus of people. Just they actually declared a curfew this year at 8 o'clock and closed the parking garages and closed roads to try to not let people in. And people took Ubers in, and people would park outside and walk in. And they almost had more visitors than they even usually have because of telling people stay away. People almost wanted to say, well, guess what? You know what? We're going to do the opposite of that. And then you get into, of course, Halloween and all the ghost tours that happened, several different companies, including ours, out there still telling ghost stories in the middle of everything. And then into commercialism that basically makes it almost a material thing that started back as a history and a tragic event and now is, I wouldn't want to say celebrated, but you get pretty close to that. And you were talking about how, there's been a little bit of a rise, even though it's a little bit more
subdued. It is there though, and we have some amazing people who do similar things. I mean, Simon Entwistle in Pendle puts on the most amazing guided tours, and he brings that part of history to life. He dresses up in Victorian costume, the ghost stories and the history, and he's so passionate, but it helps bring the history of that area to life. In some ways, I think things like that do need to be echoed in other parts of the UK, because there are just so many stories that people have no clue about, because that local history just gets lost, and because it's not taught about in school, and because it's not necessarily widely known within the community, it just goes over people's heads. And I think that's partly why, you know, this podcast and other things that happen, like ghost tours, like blogs, people who are interested in this, is so important, because it allows people to engage with some of that history. There are some really shocking things. I mean, you know, Germany, for example, had the most amount of witch trials in history. They had the most amount of executions globally. And yet, I don't know anything about that. It's hardly known in comparison to places like Salem. Scotland is number 4 in the global ranking. You know, North Berwick, which is this one tiny area in Scotland, had more witch trial executions than some whole countries, you know, alone. And those are terrifying, awful bits of history that we shouldn't forget. It takes keeping it fresh and having different approaches to keep it alive, and to for people to really engage with their local community and not ignoring it. Ask questions, find out about it. And ghost tours and all these other things are a way to be able to do that, or history tours or guided walks or whatever it is. I think we all have a responsibility to take notice and to try and keep it alive and not let it be forgotten.
Well, and I think that, and I think regardless of the contrast between Pendle and Salem, or even the United Kingdom and America, in respect to the popularity of the paranormal or whatever you want to call it, I think that what's refreshing is what you just said, is that people are demanding that we not forget no matter what happened. And that what's important now for the present and even for the future is that people are starting to learn about it. They're going on these guided walks. They're seeing these monuments. They can look it up. They can listen to these podcasts. And in Salem and in, like you said, that's it's a little bit more underground and not as prevalent in America, but that people, instead of seeing that other people are just different, they're flocking to places like this. They're finding a sense of community, and they're saying, you know what? You call them witches. Well, I call them this. Yeah. You know, you want to talk about something different? Well, guess what? We're going to make a community here. You can go to Salem, and you can have several different buildings from several different, and you know, some people wouldn't call it religion, of course, but they would call it faith or spirituality. And you have this, I don't want to just call it a celebration, but not just of history, but of people believing and being able to believe in different things and coming to, you know, not just these places, but in general, and being able to say, okay, yeah, this is different. And this might be considered taboo, but not as much as it was yesterday. And it won't be as much taboo as it is tomorrow, because it's still important. And that's why I hope that a lot of people listen to this, and, you know, whether it was the history that interested them or the sightings or the implications for the present, or just looking at the whole as a big picture, or just looking at the tiny little things that happen going forward, that I hope that they enjoyed this. And I always tell people, go back to where you live, whether it's your community or your house, even find out more about where you live, because there's going to be things that you didn't know. Not necessarily going to be on the scale of Salem witch trials or Pendle trials or like that, but people go back and they find out, and sometimes it scares them and they want to move. A lot of times they find that looking into the history and even into the stories and the rumor and the folklore of where they live, or even something that they're interested in near where they live, it connects them to that they can say, okay, you know what? I didn't know that. Let me tell you a story.
And, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because next week's podcast after this one is precisely that. I'm actually going to be focusing on a castle that is right on my doorstep. And it is, I mean, the stories it has, the history it has, the events that happen there are just unbelievable, like truly out of this world. Like, you wouldn't ever believe that it was possible. It also has lots of paranormal activity, obviously, but the history, oh, it's fascinating. But do most people know about it? No.
And that's why I hope that no matter what level of interest people have, I'm always happy just when people just ask a question or say, oh, hey, you have a ghost tour, or hey, you have a blog or a podcast. And even if they they don't remember all of it, if they remember a little bit, that's the entrance, that's the gateway to them, you know, maybe being interested in something that they didn't understand or they didn't know before, whether it's history or the paranormal or the unexplained or something else that we don't even know about yet at this point.
Yeah, it's been brilliant having you along. Do you want to just say your kind of different places where people can reach you again?
Yes, absolutely. So thank you so much for having me, Michelle. It's been a pleasure. And I just want to let everyone know that even though it is November, just like the witch trials, the Salem witch trials continued on throughout the whole year, people can still go to Salem and take a ghost tour or learn about the history on a ghost and haunted history tour in Salem. In fact, a lot of people weren't able to make it because of the pandemic or because there were huge crowds. So we say, hey, come on out for the holidays. And if you're not able to make it all the way out, you can still go to salemghosts.com and usghostadventures.com, and we have the tours recorded. So you can go on and you can watch it. It's called Ghost Flicks, and you can watch it live in some cities, or you can even watch it on demand. And there's also an app that you can go on and download. You can go to salemghosts.com to click on that app, and you can take the tour from the United Kingdom, from the comfort of your own home. You can take it out in your neighborhood. So there's all these ways so you can still enjoy this throughout the year. And of course, we have our blog on salemghosts.com and usghostadventures.com. You can find blogs in other cities about those locations and all the cool history and haunted things and paranormal and unexplained things that happen. And you can find something to do even if you're stuck at home, wherever you are, whenever you want.
So we all know what I'm going to be doing now, don't you?
Yeah,
Because
exactly.
if
There's
I
so
can
much.
do that, then brilliant. And it's great because
Absolutely.
it does, it makes it so accessible, doesn't it, for everyone wherever they are in the world, which is amazing. Thank you for joining us today on this podcast. It was a really interesting one getting to talk to Joseph. I hope you found it interesting listening to that. I'll make sure to put the links to the various different sites that they have in the description box for this episode. Go and check him out. And as I mentioned, next week, I'm going to be exploring and sharing a castle that is right on my doorstep with you. It's not one to miss. See you next time, everyone. Bye for now. If you like this podcast, you can help in different ways. Come and join us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Help spread the word with friends and family. Share the news of the podcast with other people that may be interested. Down in the description box below is also an access to Patreon, where you can continue to support the podcast further and in the process gain access to some extra goodies. If you ever get the time to write a review, I'd really appreciate it. Thank you so much, everyone.